So last night we talked about the tendency to think that about resistance as something that we need to get rid of. Resistance to unpleasant experiences so that we can be with the unpleasant experience or with experience and do the practice. And we talked about making a U-turn on that thinking and instead bringing our gentle, non-judgmental attention to resistance. As what is here, so that we don't need to have anything different in order to do the practice. And as we bring mindfulness to resistance, we can release just a little bit of our resistance to resistance, or a little bit of the judgment we have on ourselves for being resistant, not being good meditator. We can release that a little bit. And in that release, we can experience a little taste of freedom in the mind. A little bit of liberation in the mind from wanting something different. And so resistance can be a doorway to that freedom, like any other state. And then we began practicing, developing ethics, the body, the mind, and the heart, the immeasurables of the heart, in order to help expand the capacity we have for holding resistance and challenging states. It's one thing to say, oh yeah, you know, just turn to resistance with mindfulness, but these other practices help us to cultivate the capacity to do that more and more. It's hard to do that cold. Now I'm going to offer some other practices for working with resistance, all in the service of cultivating wisdom, the wisdom of how to meet experience, how to support this release in the mind, and wisdom as we talked about can rise spontaneously on its own, just kind of a, oh yeah, I never saw that before. One of our friends in the group this morning was saying they hadn't seen thoughts end the same way they did this morning. That thoughts actually end, they wane. And seeing that's profound. So we think that thoughts are so solid. Or wisdom can rise intentionally, we might realize, oh, that's what I need. I need a nap. I need some TLC. I need some compassion. And then wisdom might rise in seeing the patterns that we're habitually in, just seeing them with more capacity to hold them helps us to unwind those patterns and relearn different ones. It's kind of a mystery in a way, this wisdom. It's kind of a mystery. We kind of put ourselves into this experience, gathering our attention, expanding our mind and heart, and then we kind of get, you know, spit out the other end, or somehow there's a possibility of transformation in the middle of there. It's a bit of a mystery. Although I have Calvin and Hobbes, a word on this mystery. Calvin and Hobbes are eating breakfast. And Hobbes is the Calvin and Hobbes are at the table, and there's a toaster and there's a piece of bread on a plate. And Calvin says to Hobbes, "Want to see something weird?" And then Calvin says, "Watch, you put bread in this slot and push down the lever. And then the next panel, the toast is popping up out of the toaster, and they're both looking up at it, and Calvin says, then in a few minutes, toast pops up. And then Hobbes takes the toaster and looks inside. He said, well, where does the bread go? And Calvin says, beats me. Isn't that weird? So it's like, we're all a piece of bread and we're in the toaster at the moment. Who knows what's going to pop up? So I want to offer some internal practices, or some practices when we can think about sitting with our internal resistance, our internal difficult, challenging states. And one might be humor. Helps to give us a shift. But here's one about resistance to. As we see resistance in a different light, we can maybe cool down our ill will towards it just a tad. And we might even become friends with it. And welcome it as a messenger. For me, I often, resistance to doing stuff, resistance to the to-do list, resistance to all those things, I feel often overwhelmed. That's my form of resistance in that way. But overwhelmed, I don't want to look at it. That is an important messenger. Does anybody ever feel that way? That is a hugely important messenger that I largely ignore. But it's so big, and actually, this last week with feeling a little bit under the weather, I couldn't really do so as much, and I felt a lot less overwhelmed. That overwhelm is a messenger. That resistance is a messenger that I need more simplicity. And we say that in our minds, we know that in our minds, but resistance is an embodied message in that department. Dig our heels in. I don't want to go out tonight again. Whatever it is. So resistance can be a really big, valued, important messenger. It can remind us of our priorities. I can't resist one more Calvin and Hobbes. This is Calvin on priorities and his resistance to homework. First panel, he's looking outside the window and Hobbes is standing beside him. They're looking outside the window and they're supposed to be doing homework, right? Well, Calvin says, in the short term, it would make me happy to go play outside. And then he looks at his homework. In the long term, it would make me happier to do well at school and become successful. And then the next frame, Calvin and Hobbes are outside on the toboggan. And he says, but in the very long term, I know which will make better memories. I don't know, there's something to that, you know? So resistance as a messenger, I mean, how often am I by the window? I'd like to go outside and play. That's a big messenger. Need more downtime, more playtime. And I don't even know how to play some days. That's a skill. I actually need help in that department, but I'm not resistant to the fact that I need help. But I do. I need help in that department. Second, uh, approach I'd like to offer or suggest about resistance is to see it not only as a messenger, but as a protector. Really important protector. Especially when feelings are challenging. Because if those feelings are too challenging, there's no way, we may not have the capacity to be with them. And it's so important to pay attention to that. Especially important if we've had an intense experience with the difficulty or a traumatic experience with the difficulty. In those cases, sometimes we get a little whiff of smoke from the fire of the difficulty. Like just a little whiff of smoke, we can just sense it a little bit, and that's enough. And then we want to actually intentionally turn to something nourishing. That's how our system integrates challenging experiences, little by little. And if we actually make a misunderstanding in the practice, and I had this for about 10 years, I think, in the practice, that the practice meant being with that difficult thing, being with that difficult thing, and I would kind of push myself, and I did that when my mom died. I pushed myself to be with the grief, and it was not healthy. And that's a misunderstanding of our practice, and I think I grew up with that in the practice, that real practice, if your mindfulness was strong enough, you could be with that difficult thing. I want to debunk that myth. Real mindfulness, true, in this situation, might mean, oh, not my strong mindfulness is telling me not time to be with that difficult state. It's wisdom to say, oh, it's time to go walk, take a walk, call a friend. What's the wise response? Not always sitting with the difficulty. We can re-traumatize ourselves and get ourselves stuck in that way. So resistance as a protector is very wise in those cases. And what it means is something else is needed at the moment. Maybe it's compassion. Maybe it's something else nourishing. Michelle McDonald says this often in her retreats. No, we cannot force the bud to open. If we take the petals of the bud and pry them apart, that's not good for the bud, not good for that flower. That flower will open in its own good time. The only thing I don't like about that metaphor is that somehow there's something better about the flower budding, the bud flowering. The bud is just fine as a bud. Yeah. But it's that we often try to force that bud, thinking it should open and we should be able to do something. And we're forcing something that we need to support the conditions for that bud to do its natural thing. So resistance as a true, true protector. And then thirdly, a third way of working with resistance is to use inquiry. And this is, inquiry is a big, huge piece of our Buddhist practice. Once we settle the mind and can see clearly, the next real tool or step or wisdom practice is inquiry. We don't calm the mind just to have a calm mind. We calm the mind in order to inquire in and see what's happening. What can we learn? How can we support the conditions for peace in the heart and the mind? And so we can inquire. And one of the initial inquiries is to get to know resistance. So once our capacity to hold it expands a little bit, we can begin to be more comfortable about getting to know it. And so we can get to know what it feels like in the body. Oh, it's that little bracing feeling. It's that little feeling in the forehead. We can get to know it a little bit. And as we get to know it with this accepting attention, we befriend it even more. So get to know what it feels like in the body and in the mind. And resistance in the body can feel like tight. Resistance in the mind can feel like, for me, can feel grumpy, angry, or maybe that's more in the heart. But the mind can feel tight, and it can have quite an agenda, quite it can be quite rigid in the mind. So you'll get to know what resistance feels like in your mind. Get to know your flavor. And then inquiry can expand then, and we can really work with inquiry in with Michelle. Many teachers teach with Michelle McDonald's RAIN acronym, which many people here will know. It's always a good acronym to have in our pocket, so I'm going to explain it. So RAIN, the R is recognize that something's going on. That's the beginning of our mindfulness. Oh, resistance is here. Or, oh, there may be a challenging state here. And the A is, can I allow it? It doesn't mean accept it. Can I acknowledge it? Oh, something's going on. That's way different than denying or getting busier, using one of our strategies to ignore it. I just acknowledge, oh, something's going on. And then the I of inquiry is inquire. Get curious to the best of our capacity what's happening in order to cultivate wisdom. And then the N stands for various things. Various teachers have the N mean different things. So I'm going to go through a few examples where the N means a few different things. So one time I was on a leaving retreat. And you know how it feels so supportive on retreat. I was leaving retreat and I was driving away and I was feeling really agitated and discombobulated. And I thought, I recognized agitation. And then I acknowledged, I think this is loneliness. I drove for several more miles. Agitation still stuck there. It was still not comfy. I just couldn't, just felt like that, right? That's how it feels. And I just kind of got to know that and allowed it. And then I looked, and then I did some inquiry. And one of the biggest inquiries we can do is there resistance here? Because often it's invisible. Like, it's like an invisible shield, an invisible membrane that often we don't see. We think it's loneliness. But actually, in that case, I asked, is there resistance here? I thought, oh my gosh, it's resistance to loneliness. It's hating loneliness. And so as soon as I saw that, oh, resistance to loneliness, as soon as I saw the invisible resistance, which is often invisible, as soon as I saw it, oh, then I could, it just disappeared, and then I could touch the loneliness. And as soon as I touched the loneliness, I felt compassion, and then I felt all this love for the retreatants. And so it shifted. So as soon as we can see something clearly, it can shift when we see it clearly. I'm not saying all the time, but sometimes, so it's worth a try to see clearly. But the resistance has to be seen clearly first. Otherwise, it's like we've got cling wrap in front of us and we're trying to touch the loneliness, but we can't because the cling wrap is in the way. So resistance, is there resistance? Just that question, big question. And I didn't have to do anything once I saw it. That's one of the things that can happen with mindfulness. When we see clearly, things can dissipate at times. So another example of the RAIN, again, I was sitting on a retreat. These are two touchstone, I talk about these two a lot just because they're such touchstone experiences for me. I was sitting on retreat, and it was a retreat where we could decide how long we sat and how long we walked. So the bell did ring at the end of a sit, but I had permission to sit longer or go walking. But automatically I stood up, and then I thought, well, am I walking because I want to, or do I want to sit more? And I got uncertain. And uncertainty, for me, is a big, challenging experience. Does anybody have that? And you know, on retreat, we get sensitive, so little uncertainties can seem really big. Why? Because then we get to see them really big and we can work with them, so it's a good thing. But there I was, standing with my uncertainty. Do I walk or do I sit? Then the self-judgment came in. Jeannie, this is not rocket science. This is just walking or sitting. Self-judgment. And I thought, okay, self-judgment for me is a really big tip. That's another indication that there's some resistance. Okay, so I thought, okay, well, what's happening? So I just sat down. Actually, I didn't sit down yet. I thought, okay, what's happening? Oh, this is uncertainty. And I had the capacity, because I've been sitting for a couple of days, to recognize it. We don't always have the capacity to recognize it. So I recognized, okay, uncertainty. Can I acknowledge it? Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to sit down and check out what this is like. So I sat down and I started the inquiry. What's uncertainty like? Now, usually in life, we don't get that far because uncertainty just pushes our button, right? And we're into the default of trying to figure it out and make the right decision. That's where our mind usually goes. But when we're slowing down, cultivating our capacity, bringing in inquiry, we can do it differently. So we're unlearning that default way of trying to figure it out. I've been trying to figure it out for like a couple decades by then. Not whether to walk or sit, but this difficulty with making decisions. That was a really hard, really big groove in my mind. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to... So when we're on retreat like this, it's a big opportunity to look at these patterns. So I just thought, okay, here's uncertainty. It's really agitating. I'm going to sit down and just be with it. So I sat down and I recognized the agitation. And then as I let go of the pressure of having to make a decision, let go of that fix-it mode, I could not believe what happened. Bread had been put in the toaster and toast popped up. Because all of a sudden uncertainty was pleasant. I was sitting there and it was like, Calvin, isn't that weird? Once I let go of the pressure of fix it, then uncertainty was just quite relaxing. I didn't have to make a decision. I didn't have to feel that pressure. And I just sat there enjoying that for a while. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to go walking. And I did. So I'm not saying that that happens every time I have a decision to make now, but I have more capacity now to not get caught up in that striving and clinging and desperately trying to make the right decision. I have realized it's all right to want to make the right decision. And it's all right to have some uncertainty. So I can let the bread toast a little bit more in real life, off retreat. So it is, we have these little experiences and they cultivate some at least a different possibility for pathway in the brain. So, oh, here's another pattern you might recognize. I find myself walking around the house a lot I have a to-do list. And maybe I get near the end of that to-do list and then I have maybe a while in the afternoon I can just kind of hang out, relax. I'm going to maybe go teach that night and I've got an hour in the afternoon. Oh, but there's that one more thing. Do that one more thing. Oh, there's that one more thing. Oh, and there's one more thing. Just get that done. Well, then there's no time left to relax. Anybody do that? That's a habitual pattern. So if I'm lucky enough that I can recognize that that's going on and acknowledge it, then I can work with it with rain. And so you can acknowledge it and then inquire into what it's like in the body. It's like it's just this restless energy, pushing. And then we can inquire more. What's underneath that? That's another really good inquiry question. What's underneath this habitual repetitive pattern? Sometimes there's an emotion or something. And I realized, I had a big belief under there that resting was not okay. Sitting down and doing nothing. I've got a big judgment about that. Does anybody else have it? Yeah. That is a big driver. I'm not saying now I don't do that anymore, but I have more capacity for noticing that pattern, interrupting it, and supporting another pattern in the brain and in the mind and the heart. So this rain is really a wonderful, wonderful helper in exploring resistance, exploring challenging states. And like I had a resistance in there to ease and relaxation. So it's really helpful. It's one last one. This one's another touchstone experience for me. It was when my dad was dying and I was so agitated. I so wanted him to get well. He was 69 and he'd had emphysema for a long time. It's difficult for him to breathe, but I really wanted him to get well. It doesn't mean it's, you know, there's no tears. And I was so resistant to him being in such ill health. And so one time I was with my auntie, and you know how it is sometimes when you get with a good friend and you don't realize something's heavy, you know, so heavy on your heart till you start talking to them. And all of a sudden it comes out. And I just started sobbing with her. And so sometimes Sangha, community, friends help us through this practice. And I just sobbed, you know, that he's not going to get well. I can still remember that. He's not going to get well. And it was just, you know, the heart broke. And then after the tears and a good amount of Kleenex and pats on the back. And then Auntie said, "Oh, shall I make a cup of tea?" And we had a cup of tea. And so in that case, the I can be this intensity will pass. It's not permanent. And something else will. This lesson that's it's impermanent is big because the intense, difficult experiences we tend to think are permanent, and if we go into them, we'll never get out. So just noticing the impermanence, and just now myself thinking back on that, knowing that that passes, that's something that I took in to other griefs later, realizing that grief comes and goes. It's intense and not so intense. And earlier, before I knew that, I didn't know how to grieve. And so this going with the flow, that helped me to understand it. It gets intense and then wanes, and you can go with that flow. And so bringing impermanence in is really important wisdom when we're entering or turning to a challenging experience. And then as we do that more and more, we have a trust and a confidence that can build up. The more we do that and go through that process. So the first thing with this was seeing resistance as a messenger, and then resistance as a protector, and then using inquiry. The fourth is really recognizing impermanence and bringing that in. And the fifth is that it's okay to hate or dislike challenging emotions and challenging experiences and the pain that comes with it. We don't have to like it. That's not required. It's all right to say that we don't like them. That's real and that's true. It's not like we will welcome them with open arms, but we can know that we can navigate them. And sometimes it's unbearable. Sometimes it's just dark. I remember my sister and I had a word for it after our mom died, the abyss. Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes, a friend of mine said, sometimes swear words are the only words for cancer. The more capacity we cultivate, the more community we have to support ourselves, the more we turn to these experiences in homeopathic ways, small ways, the more we can learn to navigate them. I have a poem from Rosemary again, Wotola Tromer. It's called Surprise Grace. You know, sometimes it's just feels actually kind of a relief to say, this is just dark. This is just the way it is right now. She says, and this is the chapter when it just feels too much. Too much to turn on the light. And so you sit in the dark. This is not a myth in which you are punished, turned into a tree or a kingfisher. Nor is this a story in which you discover your own light. No, this is the night in which you are simply a lifetime of tired and unable to turn on the light. And so it's you and the night. And it's you and the night. And then it's just the night. Sometimes it's okay to just say that and just be with that. And then sometimes we want to turn and then intentionally nourish ourselves as well. Find out what it is that can nourish ourselves even in the midst of the night. One of the things that I find very helpful is nature. And I had a friend years ago who lived on the land, and she said, you know, I could never have made it through this particular difficult time in my life had it not been for nature, had I not been able to go outside. That helped sustain her through that time. There's another poem about this turning having nature support us is called The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. It says, when despair grows in me and I wake in the middle of the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests on in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting for their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. So what can really nourish and hold us in those times? The practices that we've been practicing here, the compassion practice, can nourish us. The kindness practices, the mindfulness practices, which are expanding our capacity to be with these kinds of experiences. The sense of togetherness and community, knowing that these are universal human experiences. While we were doing the compassion chant today, and I was in the standing position, I was sending kindness and care to everyone who was bowing, and just reflecting that everybody here, everyone, all of us, everybody, has joys and also sorrows. Everyone has difficult times. Just like me, everyone has difficult times. And that moved my own heart in compassion for the folks that I was sending compassion to. And then that can help me move my own heart with compassion for myself in the midst of the difficult time. Some teachers say that compassion is sometimes the only response to challenging times. Kitty Sorrow, who chanted for us today, began the Kuan Yin chant when he was in about year 2 or 3 of like a 5 or 6 year illness. He was not able to get up, he had a lot of pain, and he was in bed for 3 years. And then he began this practice of chanting Kuan Yin while he was in bed. And that was a real support for him, and he still chants it every morning, invoking and embodying that compassion, which then becomes a refuge for him and us in difficult times. Joanna Macy has 4 steps for things, what we can do in to sit with, or be with, act with difficult, challenging experiences. And she talks about them in relation to difficult, challenging situations in the world, with climate change, the climate emergency. She calls it the spiral of the work that reconnects. And her first step is gratitude. So her first step then nourishes the mind. And in her experience, there's always something that we can turn to for gratitude, always something that we can have gratitude for. And that's where she begins. She says, the spiral begins by coming from gratitude, because that quiets the frantic mind and brings us back to the source, stimulating our empathy and confidence. It helps us to be more fully present and opens the space for acknowledging the pain we carry for our world. And then the second step for her is owning and honoring our pain for the world. She says, in daring to experience it, we understand the true meaning of compassion, to suffer with, to be with in difficult times. And she says, we begin to know the immensity of our heart and mind. And if we do it together, what could isolate us in private anguish now opens outward and delivers us into the wider reaches of our inter-existence. I remember when my dad died, going to a grief group, and that was a good thing, to be in community with other people in the same loss. To know that we're not alone in our pain for the world. Let's place our pain for the world right here, right here. This is something I find very helpful to do sometimes, is to place the pain here, just place it somewhere. And we can do that as a group. We just place it right here. Whatever pain it is that you have for the world, it's right there, so that we can be with it together. Joanna's third step is that we can see then, experience our interrelationship, our shared experience, that we can see how intimately we're connected and related. And that this then can move into the fourth step, which is being able to call ourselves and each other forth into actions for the world. Here's a poem from Rosemary again, called Urgency. She says, "Again, the urge to bring gauze to the broken world and medicine and a plaster cast. Again, the urge to fix things, to heal them, to make them right. Again, the chance to do the work, which is to look in, to touch the pain, but not become it, to see the world exactly as it is and still write it a love letter. To meet what is cracked with clarity, to mirror and grow whatever beauty we find." And then she ends again her spiral back with gratitude. And so again, nourishing the mind and coming back to the things that we love about the world, the things that we care for in the world, the ways that we individually can bring our own gifts to act in the world. And there are some ways I think that this can be supported. We can definitely do it in community. I find whenever I go on a community action, like a march about climate change, I am buoyed by the community support there. It helps my system to be sustained. And also, it helps in the gratitude to turn our attention to the positive and the good that is happening in the world. One of the most inspiring things I've lately been researching on the internet is the efforts going into cleaning up plastic in the ocean. Because that was one of the things that I felt such despair about, such overwhelm about. And yet, on the internet, I've been seeing YouTube videos of the new inventions that are cleaning the ocean. Has anyone seen these on some? Yes. First of all, there was a young boy in Norway, I think it was, that said his dream was to clean up the ocean. And then he grew up, became a scientist, and he's inventing ways to clean up the ocean from plastic. And one of these inventions is a self-sustaining thing. It's like a big hoop that goes in the ocean, and then they've got some kind of something underneath there. I don't know what it is exactly. But it collects the plastic as the currents bring it in, and it doesn't engage or catch the fish plastic. And they hauled this thing out of the ocean and all this plastic in it. It's like, it's so hopeful. It's amazing. And so I need to take my mind sometimes out of the despair track and put it in the hope track. And not in a rose glasses kind of way, not in a denial kind of way, but in a way of, I've got so much energy in the world, I want to spend at least a big part of it over here. How can I support these positive efforts that are happening in the world? And so that was one that, if you haven't looked at that on the internet, go for it. Like, look it up. It's really, really wonderful. And then the other day I saw an item in the news. You know, I'm always in despair over environmental development. The latest pristine piece of wilderness that gets clear cut. My mind can go there. I decided to go in the other direction. There was an article about a ski resort area in southeastern BC called Jumbo Valley. And there it was slated for to have a 6,300 bed ski resort in it with 20 ski runs, I think. But it's now been allocated to an indigenous nation in that area, along with a lot of funds from the government for them to be stewards of that area. And they're ecstatic about that. This is a big deal. That made me happy. Made me feel like I had more energy for momentum in that direction. You know, how can we, what can we do here? Where can I put my energy here at home? And then I saw this. You know, I've been working for 15 years with treaty education and indigenous education. And when I first started 15 years ago, no one in the schools knew anything about the treaties. Now they do. And now things like this are happening. And I did that work through the Jim Sattee video and going to schools and working with students. And then by the end of that 10 years, there was a huge shift. That's when it became mandatory in the province to teach treaty education. I mean, that's been a big shift. And then I saw another news article that in Winnipeg, at a Winnipeg Jets game, the national, okay, maybe this isn't the biggest thing, but it's big in terms of awareness, in terms of public awareness. The anthem at the game was sung, Canadian anthem, in Ojibwe. I was so happy. I was so proud. I listened to that again and again and again. It just made me so happy. That's like, you know, there is a shift in, I feel, a shift in relationship possibility in this country. We're lucky to be, so lucky to be in Canada. And then how can we build community here in the Sangha? How can my heart be offered? We have a care and connection circle in the Sangha where people are a part of a little committee, and anyone that wishes for care from the Sangha can contact the care and connection committee, and we will offer metta every day for the people who feel like they need it. And that's a sense of being able to support each other. And so where can we put our positive energy? Where can we put our collective energy and grow? And I'm just sensing into some of the things I know that people in this room do. And I think if we put all our efforts that we're already doing together, that's a lot. That's beautiful. That's uplifting for me just to think about that. And so we can pay attention to the good news in the world. You know, our brains are hardwired for the bad news. They're hardwired because the amygdala and brain needs to pay attention to the threats out there. That's the survival of the amygdala and brain. And so we need to help our brain be a little bit more. So it's Velcro for the difficult. This is Rick Hansen's vocabulary. Velcro for the difficult and Teflon for the pleasant. But the fact is, pleasant is still happening. And so we need to help our brains be a little bit more Teflon for the pleasant. Velcro for the pleasant. And the way we do that is simply paying attention. Simply making it our mission for a few minutes every couple of days or a few days or a week to look for positive news. That helps the Velcro. That's all. Just look for it. Just pay attention to it. That's all. Pay attention to the gratitude. That's all that's needed to cultivate the Velcro in the brain for pleasant. And then what happens then is that our energy in that direction can increase. We have more energy in that area. The last thing I want to offer is a meditation practice that helps us or can help us to hold things with this wide view, this wider awareness, hold the challenging with our meditation practice. And in our meditation practice, what we usually do is place our attention on what's happening, what's here. There's an emotion, there's a thought, there's an experience that's here. And this last approach I want to offer is just to settle back just a little bit and sense into what it is that is aware of all those things that are going on. This may be an inquiry question that we can sense into. When there's a state present, can we just inquire, is there something that's knowing this state? And is that state the same as the thing that's being known? Like, maybe there's anxiety, maybe there's depression, maybe there's nervousness. Is feeling into these things for myself. And there can be a way that we can have this sense of a knowing of it that's not nervous. A knowing of the state that's not agitated. A knowing of the state that's not anxious. There can be a knowing of it, a kind of an awareness of it. So that's an inquiry question that we can play with. And so I just want to close by just summarizing what these suggestions have been to see resistance as a messenger, to see resistance as a protector, to use inquiry to help us explore resistance or other challenging states, especially the rain practice can be helpful. Noticing impermanence can be helpful, or bringing that wisdom in when we're contemplating or reflecting with difficult states. Touching into the difficult states in small amounts, and nourishing ourselves when we come out. Knowing that it's okay to dislike it, that's not resistance. It's all right to dislike it. Finding what does nourish us, nature, kindness, compassion practices, being in community. Gratitude, Joanna Macy's work of gratitude, honoring our pain for the world, coming together in community, and then acting according to our gifts. Turning to the good news and the positive news in the world. And then dropping this question in, what's knowing this challenging state? And see what happens. And then I'm going to just close with a poem that celebrates the, or takes a look together at the power of community, especially, or not especially, but in challenging states, the fact that we've been together today, exploring this together. All the exploration we've done just kind of can tease the solidity of challenging states, the solidity of that, can tease it apart a little bit. Help us to develop more capacity for it. So I want to just end with a nod to the gift of the community, and the gift of community in any way in challenging states, sharing with a friend, in a formal group, knowing that we're not alone. And so this is a favorite poem of our Sangha, and it's called Sangha by Christy Scherchel. And she says, Namaste, my friend. I see the light inside you. No matter the joy or sorrow that is in your heart right now, let us sit together in noble silence or conscious conversation. Let us grow together with compassion and healing grace. Let us wake up together, each as a mirror to the other, a reminder of the goodness, the truth of who we are. Let's just sit for a couple of minutes. Thank you, everyone.